This week's conversation with Lauren Yeager is sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery. In 2022, Sassy Jack Stitchery is celebrating 5 years as your needlework supplies home. Be sure to visit the Sassy Jack's website and get your kit for The Sun Always Shines at Sassy Jack's, a special design by Lindy Stitches to celebrate Sassy Jack's 5th anniversary. There are openings for the upcoming workshop, Dance of the Wildflowers, with Best Seal of Summerhouse Stitchworks, August 5 and 6. Contact Kim for details and to sign up. Also, check in at sassyjackstitchery.com regularly, as Kim will be releasing a steady stream of new sassafras samplers between now and the end of the year. Thanks to the folks at Sassy Jack Stitchery for sponsoring the show, and now on to our conversation with Lauren Yeager. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for the needlework artists. Our artist this week, and oh, this is a multifaceted artist, from the San Francisco School of Needlework and Design, Lauren Yeager. Lauren, welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for doing this. Holy
no
smokes.
No problem.
Now, this is going to be a three-hour podcast because Lauren has too much to talk about.
Oh, no.
All the things she does and has done.
Yeah.
No, we won't take 3 hours, but we may have to do a couple of shows here because there's an awful lot. The thing that fascinates me right out of the gate is making costumes for your dolls when you're a kid. When did that start?
Yeah. So when I was younger, I wasn't really allowed to play sports or, you know, those kinds of things because it was not considered ladylike. I did a lot of sewing at home, and we had a quilting shop not too far away from where I lived. And, you know, and kids never have much money, but I would buy squares and a fabric. It was one of the few things that I had any money for. And I would make different things. A lot of home decor for my toys and things like that. And it was just a lot of fun. I always enjoyed working with my hands.
So did you have someone teach you how to sew, or did you just kind of learn on your own?
You know, that's kind of funny. When I first started out, I was very curious. I had a lot of friends whose grandparents or parents had kind of crafting hobbies. My mother and father worked quite a bit, so they didn't really have any kind of hobby. So it was very fascinating. And we had things kind of laying around. So for a number of years, it was quite experimental. I would try a lot of things and guess. When I first started doing competitive costuming, a lot of it was just trial and error and doing your best. But I was pretty good at winging it a lot of the time. And I won a number of awards. You know, I would paint and dye and do all kinds of things. And at the time, there wasn't a lot of information online, so you weren't scared because you didn't see necessarily a lot of people doing things so perfectly where it was intimidating in many ways. You know, I was just doing it, and because nobody else was doing it, but nobody was telling me it was right or wrong, so there was nobody to tell you it was bad or good. And in a way, it was freeing because you didn't have any kind of I guess expectation to hold yourself up against.
How much truth is there in that?
Yeah, like yeah. You're kind of fearless, and sometimes even now, because I know in some areas how much expertise goes in. Sometimes I won't start a project because of the amount of labor that I can anticipate that might go into it. Yeah.
So you're just cutting out fabric and figuring out how to piece it together to get a dress or whatever, then you just figured
initially,
it out.
Yeah, initially, I made my first patterns for costumes out of newspapers. And I remember my mother sitting down and trying to figure it out with me. And she did not know how to read a commercial pattern. And I did not know how to read a commercial pattern. And so I just would draw out shapes, and I would drape on my friends and myself, and I would just figure it out. And over time, I learned how to read a pattern. I had a friend of mine who did costuming, but her mother knew how to sew. And I started to learn more techniques of like a proper approach. And I was very curious about it. I started off in college, and we won a fair number of awards, and we'd do these huge ensembles between 10, sometimes 14 costumes for a particular competition. And we did well, and it was a lot of fun, and it was very communal. I grew up in kind of northern North County, St. Louis. It wasn't a lot to do, so we had to create our own entertainment.
Yeah, see, I live in West County, so I wondered where you were in St.
How
Louis.
How funny. Yeah, there just wasn't a lot to do. I never drive, so I didn't go anywhere. So we would all make costumes, and we'd pool our money together. And as I got older, I still did it, and I was refining techniques, but there was a lot I didn't know and I couldn't figure out. And some books were helpful, but it's almost like a lot of sewing books, unless you know that it's there, you can't necessarily find it. So, I was going to school and I was studying, art, at Truman State University, and I was making costumes at the time, but it was, you know, everybody kind of was like, oh, you know, that's a hobby. That's something you do in your free time. It's not anything you would do for a living. And I was taking art classes and I volunteered in their theater department and I worked there. But I didn't quite fit in because, you know, a lot of people in theater, it's all encompassing. You know, you're involved so much in theater. And for me, I really couldn't care too much about shows. I really just like the making part. Like, I like to put on a show. I like to participate. But really, once the objects are complete, I'm kind of, you know, like, to me, that's the end of my role in that. Yeah. And so I was kind of unhappy. I had a professor at Truman who was pretty much of the opinion that clothes could not be art. That what I was doing was, you know, not to be valued in any way. And I thought, well, you know, I don't particularly care for that. And I wasn't particularly happy at that institution. So I went to Chicago and started studying there, where there was this sort of idea. Because, again, growing up in the Midwest, you know, people who work in the creative field are people that do not live there from the perspective of my family and a lot of people that I knew. Maybe you have hobbies, perhaps, but even that was considered quite frivolous. So when I went to Chicago, people were much more open to the idea. You know, there are artists working much more openly, and the accessibility was there. So I really enjoyed my time there. And I graduated with a BFA in fashion design with sort of an idea that I would go on and I would do costume, but with a more technical understanding of garment making.
Now, it's interesting to me. I've known several people who went to the Columbia School and for various things, and seems to be a good school. But interesting to me that we've talked to a good handful of people who started out in the fashion design area and then over time moved away from that.
I always intended to go towards a costume bent, but after my experiences at Truman State, the way that the theater department ran is, even if you were a costume person, you didn't really specialize. You know, you took all kinds of different classes. So it was, in my opinion, and I know not everybody shares this opinion, that it was a very watered down experience, because to make garments, you need to have a wide understanding of materials, and you need to be speedy, and you need to know how to drape and cut and pattern and solve all kinds of problems that, you know, 15 credit hour minor is just not going to do. And I always thought very strongly, it doesn't matter what shows you've read, what books you've read, you're going to get a script from a designer and they're going to have you read it. And maybe you've read it already, but who cares? You know, the director's going to tell you what they want. And so I thought, well, you know, I'm going to cut out the middleman and I'm going to become very well-rounded, because I recognized very early on that these are competitive fields. I had a professor the first day of school pretty much kind of like give us really, really hard statistics on how successful we would be in the fashion industry. But, you know, the creative industry is very much like that. And I always say working in art is, it's a business. You know, you don't get up and it's frou-frou, like la, 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 and today we'll create. It's, you know, it's a job. You get up every day and you work very hard. And, you know, if you mess up or something's not successful, you only have yourself to blame. And it's, you know, and it when you do fail, it is harder, because, again, it's your creative this and that. So I was really happy because I really got something out of it that not only could I monetize on my own if I ever never really got to do it full time, but I could make things and I was empowered to make things better and better. And I loved it. And then I was accepted into a graduate school position at UMKC. And when I went there, it was not really, interested in the construction aspect. You know, they liked design and they liked other aspects of what they were doing. And I thought to myself, you know, I'm a technician. I like to be a technician. I want to be a technician. Lots of designers are out of work and a lot of people really need to put their names all over everything. And to me, that's not important. I'm most happy when I'm making the object, whatever it may be.
So, and, okay, so I got to back you up there. So then there's really two facets then. There's the people who just take the pencil and sketch the lines and on a figure and say, here's my new design. And then what you are interested in is the person who takes that and finds a cloth and figures out how to piece it together.
Yeah, because in a nutshell, if I'm going to see Wicked on Broadway, I don't see the designer's illustrations. I see what's executed by the technicians.
Right.
They're realizing somebody else's design, but nobody's going to see a series of pictures unless you, you know, spend $100 to get some book, assuming there's even a book on that subject. And then again, like, clothes are so interesting because they're three-dimensional, they're tactile, and I have a great love of materials. Anyone who's ever met me or knows me from classes knows that I have tons and tons of stuff. I buy lots of fabric, lots of different materials to work with, to sort of master, to know how they're going to behave and operate with whatever task that I'm sort of set to. So I was in a graduate program and they very much looked down on technicians. And I thought to myself, like blue collar versus white collar work. And I thought to myself, you know, technicians really have to think on their feet and do so much because that industry in many ways, you don't have one person that just really does one thing. You know, they have to, you know, fill a myriad of positions. And at that time I had worked for Nick Cave, doing handwork, working on sound suits, large scale productions in the fine art realm. And I was like, this is what's needed. People who can actually execute the work. Everybody is a dreamer with a sketchbook and says they want to be a designer. And I hear that from students and people all over the place. But it's like, it's the execution what matters, not always just the concept. Like, theory needs to be informed by practice and vice versa. So I was working in the field and the majority of the people I was in school with were not that interested in making. Again, they were beautiful illustrators. They liked to design, but I still wanted to make and they wanted me to be a designer, not really a maker. And I decided, you know what, I know how to make clothes because so many of the students that were there, you know, they had that 15 hours. You know, I'm a minor in costumes. So they didn't really know how to sew. They weren't particularly good at pattern making. And I said, well, you know, I really don't enjoy this. And I really want to do my own work in a different way. That's not the art of almost. Because sometimes in some theater based on budget, you know, you're doing what the budget will allow. But for me, and in my mind, if I'm studying a craft and I'm paying money to do so, however much, and I did have a scholarship at that at school, is it's a situation where I really want to learn the highest end that I can to prepare me to go and work in the industry. And the art of almost is also the art of not quite. And so I said, you know, I'm going to go and I'm going to find something different. And I stumbled upon the Royal School, which I had already.
Back up.
Sorry.
That's all right. No, it's interesting. But this Nick Cave, that's mentioned quite a bit in the research that I did.
Sure.
What is Nick Cave art? What's that? What was that experience like? What did you do there?
So I was a sewing technician for Nick Cave, and we hand sewed everything and we assembled everything. And for anyone who's not familiar with sound suits, they're very elaborate sculptural objects as well as costumes worn by performers, and they're excruciatingly labor intensive and they're stunning and beautiful. And I love okay, doing that work.
I got to learn about this whole thing. So Nick Cave is
he's a visual artist. He's a visual artist, and he operates a studio in Chicago, and I believe is represented by the Jack Shaman Gallery in New York. But sound suits are what Nick Cave is famous for, and they're heavily embellished sculptures as well as costumes, if you would, for dance performers.
Hmm. So give an example of a sound suit, and why is it called a sound suit?
So sound suits make sounds. The materials sort of interact when the wearer is moving in them. They generate noise. And depending on what the sound suit is made of, they can be made from sticks, hair, raffia, buttons, different types of objects. A lot of them found objects or vintage objects, repurposed materials. And in many ways, it's what helped me train for production because, you know, in that kind of labor intensive art, every second matters because if you're not doing something efficiently, you know, one of the things that we had to do is create button suits, and button suits had thousands and thousands of buttons. So you had to sew like 1,000 buttons in an 8-hour period by hand. And they all had to be double stitched because the sculptures are very heavy. And so everything has to be well made because otherwise it's going to, you know, not turn out well, and it's not going to live well in the museum or on a dancer's body. So I had this sort of realization that you could do this very, very elaborate work and you can make a living off of it. And you're not going to be a millionaire, but, you know, I worked right out of college doing production work for a well-known artist. And, you know, it was a regular paycheck. There wasn't, you know, weeks where you didn't have work. You came in every day, like a 9-to-5 job, and you went to work to help produce these shows, and they were huge. The pieces were all very elaborate, and the amount of labor was just more and more and more, but they're stunning and they're beautiful. And when you go into an exhibition of Nick Cave's work, there is something going on in Chicago at the moment. Installation of his work, I think at MoMA, I don't remember offhand, but you it's striking. You go into these rooms, and just these objects are so visually striking, and they're tall. Many of them are 7 or 8 feet, and they all have very similar silhouettes, but the embellishment from one to another is always pretty distinct.
And you had to make them in how much time?
So it was a team, depending upon the volume of work that was produced for whatever show. I was core staff and there would be interns and however many needed to execute a particular show. So it varied quite a bit. I think at maximum I might have worked there when there was maybe, I don't know, 18 or 19 people. I could be a few off. And then during other times, I think there was only 6 of us at a time. But again, it's a lot of discipline because you have to sit there and you've got to work and keep your head down and you have to keep to a time. And when you're making work for individuals, time is money. If you want to eat food and live in a house every day, you have to reasonably produce objects to sell in that time frame, you know, like, at, you know, at some sort of reasonable market value. Because, you know, I remember being in college and there would be students who made, you know, like a men's Oxford shirt, and they'd say, well, you know, I'm going to charge $1,000 for this shirt made out of, you know, Walmart material because that's how long it took me at this price. And I said, well, that's not a reasonable expectation for you to get paid that. So you need to buckle down and figure out what is your system, or you decide this is too much labor. I'm not going to do this because this is not commercially viable. So, you know, worth versus, you know, is it commercially viable? Those are two different things. Like, I can value my work for $1 million. Does that mean somebody's going to pay for it? No. So I worked in production, and again, it was a regular 9-to-5 job for a number of years.
How do you keep that from just sapping your enthusiasm for creating?
You know, I've never understood people who get too tired to work. I don't. That to me is just not my wheelhouse. When I was working for Nick Cave later on, because I initially worked there, I was, you know, sent away to graduate school, And then I came back when graduate school, I was really disillusioned by graduate school because so many people, particularly undergraduate students, they're trying to stave off the inevitable of going to work, you know, for maybe not in the field, some boring job where they're going to be, you know, they're going to be, you know, bottom individual. And, you know, they're not going to call shots. They're not going to design. They're going to execute if they're even lucky. And so I went to graduate school and it just did not fit. Like, I'm a very independent person. I found out very much that I like to work next to people, not with people. I will produce what you want me to produce, but I want you to leave me alone while I do it. And I didn't like the kind of work that you have to collaborate with in a group of designers. I'm like, I know what I need to do. Do you know? And I remember there was some student who shall remain nameless, and she was a second year, and she did not know how to put a bodice in a dart. You know, a dart and a boss, excuse me. And I remember being like, in 2 years, you couldn't figure that out. And so I was like, that's when I knew I have to get out of here. So I went back, and by that time I had started with the Royal School.
Hey,
and
I'm going to interrupt you here. Nick. I just want, I want credit for knowing what a dart and a bodice are. I just want credit for that. Okay. You can move on now.
I like it. So I went back to work for Nick Cave's studio, and again, the work's very hard. It's hard on your hands. Repetitive motion injuries can happen. And I worked a lot. I worked a lot of overtime so I could pay for, I'm not a millionaire. I paid for my embroidery education, as anyone who's taken a class with the Royal School or taken embroidery classes in general. They are not cheap. And everybody thought I was insane. I said, you know what? I want an embroider because it's the same type of work. Well, I love over the top embellished work. I always loved it. And embroidery is, you know, the facilitator of a lot of elaborate work in many ways. And I thought, well, somebody's doing this for a living. Why can't it be me? So I concocted this very elaborate plan that I would specialize as much as I could. And I would learn everything that I could at every opportunity that I could reasonably pay for to help launch what I hoped in future would be some sort of part-time career on the side of whatever I was doing professionally. And maybe one day I'd work in it full time. And everybody thought I was a lunatic. They're like, embroidery, nobody makes money at that. And I said, well, somebody somewhere is doing it. You see it. You don't know this weird path that people get themselves onto. But I saw it, and I was very one single-minded. So I would work, you know, 60-hour weeks, and I would go home and I would work some more. And all my vacation days would be spent going to study, going to work. And I remember people telling me, "What, work smarter, not harder?" And I'm like, working smarter sometimes just is working harder. And I just put in the hours. I tell people all the time, do not do this unless you love it, if you want to be a professional. And it is all the time. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I put in hundreds of hours of work, and I would work late into the night and on weekends. And again, repetitive motion injuries would come up and about. But in the end, it paid off. But I held no illusions about being, you know, some people go to art school and they're like, I'm going to be a famous artist. And you're like, and they risk themselves financially in their endeavor, in this quest to be well-known, famous, noticed, what have you. And I never risked so much money where if there was ever a setback, I would not be irreparably damaged. So that was my strategy overall. But again, along the way, people thought I was nutso studying embroidery with all these institutions, all at the same time, mind you. Because someone was like, oh, well, you know, you're doing this. And I'm like, yeah. And then I studied at LaSalle. And then I studied with the Royal School. And then I studied with the JUC. And I worked full time. And I would take commissions on, again, any kind of extra boost of cash to help me pay for all these crazy expensive materials. But I loved every minute of it. I mean, sometimes I was just so tired. I would do, like, when I would do the intensive, the Royal School, I would plug between 150 and 200 hours in that 2 week time period. Ooh. And I would come home and I would instantly become sick.
Yeah.
I would just come home and collapse in a pile. But I was always very proud of myself. And I said, well, you know, even if I don't do this for a living in the long term, I can say I have this skill and I can do it for myself. And, you know, It was very important to me for reasons unknown. I love to make, and I want to make well. I don't like doing things by halves. I want to know exactly what to do. I want to have expertise in it. And so I always work that way. But again, it's like a compulsion. It's like, I guess what some people wake up and they're like, I have to wash my hands 10 times. I'm like, I need a needle in my hand, and I need to work, and I don't feel good if I don't.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a need. It's not just a want, it's a compulsion, you know?
Well, we've talked to numerous people who are graduated from one program or another at the Royal School, and every single one of them, for me, it's if you learn nothing else from that experience, you will learn whether you love needlework or not, because,
Very true, yeah.
yeah.
But I'm, even within the parameters, it's like I am a workhorse. People will be like, how did you do all that work? And sometimes I go, I have no idea. But I did a lot of competitions. I worked in such a way where I could make myself finish a project. I have a lot of students, and sometimes they say they struggle and they finish. And I said, like, you can always finish. Maybe you don't finish today, you don't finish tomorrow, but you can finish 6 weeks from now. I pretty regularly engage in projects that take several hundred hours. And I recently produced a reproduction of an 18th century petticoat. And I think it was probably 500 hours of quilting. And I just did it. It's like, well, why not? And because I said, well, I can't go to the museum and say, I would like to have this artifact, please. So I have to make it myself if I want to have it. And I did, and I sat down and I would plug in hour after hour, day after day, until you're done. And then that's kind of how I work.
So what drives you to do that? What, I mean, do you feel like you, because we've discussed this too, because Gary's not so much of a finisher of projects, but it seems like the drive
Hey, I
to finish one,
resemble
what
that.
makes
Wait a
you
minute.
too funny.
What makes you decide, I just have to finish this project? I mean, it just is it seeing it completed?
I'm a very stubborn person, and I do idiotic rules for myself, like rules to live by. And I was raised where money did not come easily. I had to earn it. And I said, if I'm gonna buy it, I'm gonna finish it. Like, that's it. Like, I bought it, I spent time on it. There's something to be learned here. And not to say that there have been projects that I haven't finished, but I never give up on projects. So I often work on around 8 to 10 things at a time, and when I get frustrated or I need a break, I cycle through. So there'll be, sometimes some months where I'm finishing all these things, and you feel like Superman. But I just, you spent good money on this. I don't, as a professional artist, I don't earn lots and lots of money. So if I'm paying for a project or materials, I and also there's like guilt. I know a lot of people that hoard materials and never put them to any kind of use. And so it's like, I don't want to, hoard materials, not use them, and then feel like I wasted my hard-won earnings. Because, working in art, it's tough. There are lean years as well as better years. And so, not to say that I don't probably buy more than I need, but it's important for me to use them because, money is not infinite. And also too, like, I'm not somebody who spends a lot of time, I think, going out to parties or socializing in that way. I get very excited to sit down and sew or sit down and embroider. It's just kind of part of my routine, and it just finishing is important. It's like, it's not important that it's perfect. It's important that it's finished. So I hate UFOs. They haunt me in the night,
I think it's just a different people look at projects in different ways, and so I belong to a guild, and so you have the whole range, the whole gamut. You have people who will pretty much only work on one project at a time, and there's people like me,
For
and I
sure.
have 20 to 50 whips, going at a time, and but so it's I'm just I'm always curious to see what makes you the desire to finish things, or even the opposite, the desire to start things. Why do you, what does this need to start everything?
I get excited, you know, in this day and age, I am a millennial. FOMO is a thing. I will definitely say that working, whether I liked it or not, whether I was enjoying the technique or not, was immaterial. The deadline is this. This needs to be done. And so you train yourself to not necessarily pull through discomfort, but it's just, you know, it's there are parts of life, well, as you know, as your job, some are more enjoyable than others. It's just a part of that process. But I mean, there are like mental tricks that I'll do if I'm stuck or if something's particularly tedious, like quilting, I find a little bit tedious because it's just one technique and it's infinitely repeating that. The repeat that I did was 50 inches by 40 inches with, 8 stitches per inch. So I had to be at times take a break. And so I would do something else. I did some needle painting projects in between. I made pin cushions in between just for a little bit of a break here and there, which I do think can be important. So again, I finished most of the things that I start out, but they're not always finished sequentially where I started it and then I ultimately stopped. Why I do start some projects, I don't know. I fall in love with stuff the way that people do. You see something and you think about it, and I don't generally forget things. I will have a strong impression from an object that I really like for a very long time. And it's so funny. It was a pair of shoes I wanted to buy, and they're exorbitantly expensive. I think they're like $900 shoes. And I remember waiting for them to go on like clearance, you know, bottom clearance, inexpensive. And I waited for these shoes, you'll love this, for 2 years to go on sale until they were $100. And I bought them. And I remember someone saying to me, they said, you were in a relationship with these shoes for longer than some people stay married. And I said, yes, I am committed. And I thought, if I'm honing in on something, I do not go away. I will be there forever and ever. Amen. And I guess, personality-wise, I suppose I fixate more than anything on uncertain things. I don't kind of flit about. Like, people go, oh, you know, when you're younger, they're like, you're going to be a very different person as you grow older. And I'm like, I like all the same stuff, just more intensely. And, you know, as an adult, I earn my own money, so I can empower myself to both do what I've always wanted to do. And it's kind of silly. Like, I've been doing this sort of thing since I was probably 10 or 11, and I just do it more as I've aged. I never really said, oh, I don't like this anymore. I kind of shift through some techniques from time to time, but I've always sewed costumes and home furnishing objects and collected miniatures and all that stuff. I'm 5 years old, secretly, forever and ever.
Was there some specific point or catalyst that moved you away from costume making and more to a hand needlework emphasis, embroidery, stump work, all those things?
Sure. So when I was doing costume, I always did embellishment. Most of the costumes had a high degree of embellishment, particularly for the competition pieces, because that's what wins the trophy. But as far as when you go to the Royal School or Lesage or even the JEC, most people, I think these days, that are embroiderers, they want to make a pretty picture that they hang on their wall. And so just that the way that you're taught is that's what those objects are. Like, that's the purpose, that's their function is, you know, like, but I still always made embroidered objects for other purposes or garments for clients. But I do enjoy, and I have quite a few wall-mounted pieces. I think just for the market, people are more willing to invest in something that's decorative for the home that's going to maybe hang up for 10 to 15 years versus a garment that may fit for or be appropriate. You know, we're not a society that's going to the opera and, you know, evening gowns, assuming anyone even wants to go to the opera. You know, they might do it in just a casual outfit. So just, I think the context for embroidery has changed for most people away from fashion, if ever really focused on fashion, to more, you know, like decorative objects, things that you can you know, that operate almost like a furnishing, and people feel a little bit more comfortable investing their time and effort into something like that they can't spill a glass of wine on or smear cheese on, you know.
Right, right.
But I do enjoy both. It, you know, it's one of those, you know, people always say, oh, I'm in love with whatever I'm doing right now. And I'm like, that's pretty true. I think stump work's really fascinating because all techniques fit into stump work. And so I like it for that reason, that I really don't have to be limited. But I do a fair amount of needle painting, and I do a lot of Japanese embroidery.
What serves your creative needs more? Is it the costume making and embellishment, or is it just straight needlework, hand needlework?
I mean, a lot of the costumes I do make by hand. I can use an industrial, I was trained in an industrial. I've worked in shops where I did everything by hand. I've worked in shops where, you know, you use a machine. But it's the handwork that I really love because, you know, a machine's kind of noisy. I like to put on an audiobook. I do lots of audiobooks and I kind of go away. But what machine's loud and, you know, you have to pay a little bit more attention. In that way, you know, cause it's the speed of it kind of changes things around. Like right now I'm working on a redding goat, and even though I only have a month to make it, I'm still going to do it by hand. I made my mock-up with my machine. But you know, that's cause it's a throwaway piece, but it's the handwork. I love to make things by hand, but I love the materials, you know, the silk, the linen, the this, the that. And there's so many right now, you know, things like Etsy and artists can do so much that when I first started out, you know, you're wholly unaware of all these different product lines that you can get because, you know, some special artisan, one of my favorite embroiderers of all times, Jenny Aiden Christie, and I am always in awe of the materials that she has at her beck and call, you know, to design with. And some of them I think are made specially for her. And that to me is what I love. I love buying thread. I could buy thread just over and over and over again. Like just you see this little rainbow in your hands and you go, I'm going to do something with this. I love the material and I fall in love with the material usually even before I select a project. I might have something in mind, but once I purchase the materials, then I really get going because you get to touch stuff and cut stuff and, you know, sew on it. And then it moves from like this intangible fantasy into the realm of reality where this is not just a concept. This is a real life object. Like I can go into my cupboard and pull out a petticoat that otherwise is only in a museum. And so there's like a little bit of a, you know, I have like a curated museum of my own that is just my house. Like I don't buy like Target art or, you know, that kind of hotel art. Most of the art in my house is made by people or myself. So it's not, you know, chock full, but I feel like that's what's more important, you know. Having these
target art
objects.
Target art. There's my new term right there. That's
yeah,
good. Target
yeah.
Art.
I'm like, yeah, I grew up with what I would call like, you know, just mass produced consumer. It's sterile. There's nothing to it. And one of the things I've talked about quite extensively is I have a very good memory, but when I think about the objects that I've made, like when I kind of walk through my house and something catches my eye and I kind of think about it for a minute, I can really remember where I was in my life at that moment, what I was doing, what I was thinking. So in a way, it's kind of like a diary because you just have this tactile memory when you look at these objects. And so your relationship with them is longer because most of the projects I do, you know, 100 hours minimum for most things, because otherwise, why even get started? You know, what's the point if it's less than 100 hours? You know, you really have a relationship with this object over time. And so it's so much more evocative of memory because it's not just one day, one afternoon. You know, it's like, oh, for 6 months I worked on this project. And I remember, again, what was going on at that time. It's a lot more vivid versus, you know, I went on a shopping trip and I bought a purse. You know, like maybe I'll remember that and maybe I'll forget that. But, you know, anybody who's gone to the store and purchased something, if it's destroyed, you're like, I don't care. You know, I bought that at Target. It, you know, there are millions of them out there just like it. But if you come to my house, all the things that I have are pretty unique. They're pretty unique to me in my home, and they make me very delighted.
That's going to be my first question to the next designer we talk to. Do you do Target art?
I know. I've never understood like why everybody wants to have just the same print of Monet's water lilies in their house. I'm like, it's been done to death. My mom had stuff like that. Like, I remember we have, like, again, just Target art all throughout the house. And I don't know, it just reminds me sometimes of a dentist's office. I would never tell her that. She won't listen to this podcast.
Oh, I don't know. She's been listening from day one. I don't know.
Oh, no. She does. She doesn't like to use the iPhone for, so thank you.
Oh, okay.
I love handmade things, and they don't have to be things that I've made, but they really tell a story, and, you know, they're unique. Even if people are making the same kits, like I teach a lot of my classes and their kits, but everybody's piece, you know, you can tell who made it a lot of the time. Their personality kind of comes through in the way that they work, and I think that's very, I know, I find that very delightful.
There's really, in your career and in your work, an appreciation for history?
Yeah. I love historical embroidery. Like, sometimes I get sassed a little bit because I'm not a contemporary artist. Particularly, I worked for a contemporary artist and contemporary artists for a number of years. I love the incredibly light labor-intensive embroideries. There's just something about them that it's just such a huge investment of time. I'm very fascinated about this idea of how you spend time with objects and to what purpose. That I just, you know, I'm just not going to do a 20-minute embroidery. I'm going to spend 100 hours, 200 hours, 500 hours to make something that's going to be quite exceptional. And I remember I used to have like a little, it wasn't a photo bucket. I think it was like a DeviantArt account. And I'd had some friends where, you know, they posted their work and people copied it. And someone asked me, who kept their own portfolio very private, they said, aren't you worried about people copying your work? When I finally sort of went live, and I said, I would love to see people try to copy my work. And I've had a couple people ask me, like, somebody wanted to digitize my petticoat pattern, and I said, well, it uses 126 spools of silk. And they said, never mind. And I said, that's what I thought. But yeah, people don't copy my work. You know, people who are willing to do that amount of work, they've got their own ideas and their own execution of how to produce in that way. But I, you know, I also get to share, like, my work's not 100% unique. I do a lot of representational work, but it's, you know, it's fairly skillful, and it takes a lot of time. And I appreciate other people who are willing to spend the time, because, you know, embroidery, a lot of people don't think it's as technical as it is. I mean, especially for some artists, there's a huge amount of refinement, and you really have to humble yourself before the work, and you have to practice. People always are like, oh, you know, I spent this amount of time, and I'm like, there's no sort of substitution for practicing your craft. You know, there's no like smart way to work. There's just, you practice, you understand what the materials will do, will not do, under what, you know, circumstances, and that's just it. And I think, again, it's very worthwhile to maintain the integrity of historical craft, because it's going away, and I think that's such a shame, because what do we do with our time? You know, we're swiping on a phone, staring off into space, but well, oftentimes we're staring at other people who are doing and producing. I know we're not staring at a, you know, an advertisement for sunscreen or Pepsi or whatever, but you know, we're usually like admiring, like I will go online, and if I spend any time online, I'm looking at other people's handmade work. I think it's such a shame that a lot of these art forms are dying, because people are not willing to put in the real time and effort and dedication. I really feel quite dedicated to the work that I do.
In your work at the school there, San Francisco School, do you see that pendulum swinging back where people are starting to put their phones down and want to do more handwork? I mean, I think that the pandemic has driven that quite a bit, but do you see it holding?
Yes. You know, I do, and for a couple of different reasons. So, you know, I had to go through the rigmarole of studying with a royal school. And again, I appreciated my time there, but it was a huge expense. Lesage, you know, the JEC, it's incredibly costly. And I was very privileged to be able to, you know, save that kind of money, not have health problems, work through what I did to get where I am at this point. And that's not necessarily a realistic expectation for people. There could be the want or the will, but it costs money. I supported myself. I've had you know, received study grants to help me develop my body of work. But cost and time is a huge consideration, particularly for younger people. I started getting involved in embroidery professionally in my early 20s when you're broke as a joke. And there were times it's like I have $22 in the bank and I can buy nothing until I get paid again. And you're like, and then, but I'm going to spend, you know, $5,000 going halfway across the country or to another country to look at this stuff. So access for years, I think there have been a lot of people who want to know how to do this. And, you know, there wasn't really a school in the United States. And, you know, younger people in particular, they want to know, and they're not the teachers that have the time or the inclination. Because college is set up very differently. You know, a college is not going to, it's not a technical school. And a lot of technical schools have gone away. And, you know, some companies even say, hey, we want Made in America. And I said, well, but we don't know how to even get a person to train our workforce. What we provide at the school is, you know, facilitation to support learning. You know, we have a gallery space to showcase work and encourage other people to share their work. But, you know, we really want to provide an experience for stitchers, whether if it's just a hobby for relaxation, health and healing, or if they're interested in pursuing a career for maybe to have their own business, perhaps to teach, or again, maintain a cultural heritage piece like Japanese embroidery. You know, it's very labor intensive. You have to, again, humble yourself before the work and dedicate your time. It's not a casual dip your toe in kind of thing. And that there's value in maintaining the integrity of these things. And there's a lot of cultural heritage, you know, experiences and artists to share. So one of the things that I did is I studied with master crafts people periodically, because again, a lot of them don't have apprentices or people to share their work with before they go. And they're, you know, many people, they're getting older and they're like, I want to share what I know and I don't have anyone to share it with. And they're not books that you can pick up on a lot of these subjects. You know, it's word of mouth, it's communication and practice and, you know, time. And that's really what we want to sort of maintain and promote within the school. We also want to encourage people to be creative. So for example, I'm going to be teaching a class in the fall that's about stitching solutions. If you have a project that you'd like to create, but you don't know how, I'm there to kind of guide you through this process of development and creativity and, you know, focus techniques. And then we're rolling out in the fall as well, a professional training program for people who might want to create a product line. You know, how do you go about that? How are you going to brand yourself and do these different things so you can be as successful as possible? Because the earliest part of my career was the hardest. You know, people didn't know who I am. And I know there are a lot of artists out there that are very underpaid. And if you can't pay your bills, you're not going to be an artist for long, because you just, and I tell people all the time when they complain about my prices, I said, well, I'm accustomed to living in a house every day and eating food every day, et cetera. And just so many people, all they think about is the fact that they want something that they either cannot afford or are unwilling to pay the real cost of it. And it's like, look, you know, you have to pay people appropriately. You would never go to a doctor or a dentist and go, well, I have to have this done, but I'm only going to give you this amount of money because that's what I feel like I ought to give you, regardless of how much time, money, you know, time and effort and material goes into whatever it is that you do. You'd never do that.
Right.
But people do that to artists all the time. And the artists that fall susceptible to this sort of cycle hurts all of us. because, you know, there are people who, in their desperation to pay a bill or to get started, they undercut their own value. And it, you know, and it hurts other professionals for them to do that, but it hurts themselves. And those are the artists that oftentimes fail because, you know, they're in a situation that there is no good outcome to continually undersell. You're just going to exhaust yourself and you're going to develop a client base that's going to perennially take advantage of you.
Right. Well, that's what's happened. You know, that's what's happened with art photography. You know, everybody's a photographer now because they all have a camera in their pocket. And people are willing to let anybody use a photo for fame and glory, and then the truly good photography you can't get money for it, and that happens time and time again with art, and I'm sure we've all been asked, you know, what a beautiful needlework piece, would you sell it? Well, no, you can't afford it. You just can't afford it because I can't get enough money out of it. For the hundreds of hours I put into it, it just is not happening.
Yeah. I was charged an hourly rate, and people are like shocked by that. I'm like, you know, like that's what it is. And I don't need, like, I'm not desperate for work in the sense because I have reliable jobs that I, you know, take on in addition to the teaching work that I do. It's like, I'm not going to be predated on, and I'm not going to give people what they want because they think I'm desperate for, you know, money at a particular moment. So I'm pretty strict on that. And also too, with the school, I feel very firmly, I want to, as a teacher, because it was very hard for me, again, like not being, you know, the Royal School's in another country. So it was Lesage, the JEC is very expensive. And it was such a fight. And again, like working so much and, you know, the repetitive motion injuries and sometimes going, you know, sitting there. Cause it was a long process. I studied pretty intensely for about, 7 years before I was able to teach full time. And there are moments where you just go, how can I keep on this path? I don't see a good end to security and happiness and all these things that we fantasize about. So at the school, I really want to do my best to teach people, not give them, you know, an overblown, unexpected or an unreasonable expectation, but to sort of create this environment where we make the possibility, like the possibility is there through hard work and this and that, but we want to, you know, give people the ability to do something, you know, worthwhile and meaningful and, you know, potentially professionally, if that's the route that they want to take, because, you know, the kind of support that you get from other institutions is going to go along with the students that are around them. Like I've always thought it was quite fantastic at the Royal School, you know, that they promote their teachers, they talk about them, you know, they get, you know, they've written books on behalf of the Royal School for their different things. So it's like, you need that when you're starting out, you need somebody to support you, to believe in you, to help you get your name out there. And that's one of the roles that I want the San Francisco School with myself and Lucy Barter and Lisa Cassino and to do. We want to help people until they can kind of stand on their own 2 feet if they want to engage in work like this.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You've mentioned repetitive use injuries a couple of times. Is that something you deal with? You've learned to manage? Because that can be, I mean, that's a very real thing.
Yeah.
And
well, I'm very fortunate that I don't have any kind of early onset arthritis. I have given myself nerve damage and through repetitive motion injury. When I worked building fiber sculptures, sometimes it was like a lot of pressure, and the speed at which you worked and the amount of hours that I worked, I did like give myself on occasion some pretty bad tendonitis. Like, you know, you just have a shooting pain going all the way up into your shoulder and back. And there were days where it's like very painful to work and you had to do it. So, I mean, you do have to be aware of your body. You do have to sometimes say no to work because you physically cannot do it, or you're going to hurt yourself real bad. And sometimes the recovery can be a long time. I'm a firm believer in acupuncture. I know some people don't care for it, but it's been very effective to help me manage, joint swelling and all that kind of stuff. But also, like, I try to do good posture. I do yoga every day, which helps. But yeah, you know, you do have to physically take care of yourself, because there are fiber artists, as well as artists in other fields, that literally wreck their body in their, you know, quest to produce a huge volume of work. So I do, you know, believe in regular maintenance for, you know, care of your hands and your back and your eyeballs and all that good stuff. But I still do put in long days if I'm in a lot of pain. I do take a break if I'm in a lot of pain, because I don't have to work under such intense deadlines as I used to. I'm not old by any stretch of the imagination, but it can be quite wearing. The amount of work I used to do did take its toll a little bit.
But you've learned the techniques and learned what you have to do to keep yourself flexible and to break up the repetitiveness.
Well, it's not even that. I will say that, you know, when you first get started, you know, you get paid very poorly, a lot of the time. And it's just, I'm not at that point in my career where I have to work as much as I used to make the same or more money, which, you know, that's what you should experience. Just like in a regular job, the more you know, the more expertise, the faster, more efficient you are, you're going to get paid more. It's just more or less that I earn more money, so I don't have to work, you know, more than, right. You know, I don't have to put in 70 hours anymore to make it all work out. And again, like, you do have to check in with yourself. I've had friends who like put themselves in the hospital. So you do have to be aware of your physical limitations if you do have them. And everybody has some sort of limitation up to a point. Because again, if you hurt yourself so badly, you're not going to enjoy the work, because you're just going to be in pain. But again, I do believe very firmly in yoga. That really helps me out.
Right. Do you do any massages? Do you get massages also? Because I know
not
that
so
that's
so much anymore. I kind of used to. Acupuncture, again, like, some people think that it's hokey and what have you, but I've really found that acupuncture is what keeps my hands in good fighting shape. Because I used to get a lot of swelling, a lot of hand swelling. And again, like, where your knuckles all lock up until you like crab, I call them crab claws. So for me, that's a really effective non-invasive treatment, for overwork. Not everybody is into it, which I don't necessarily understand, but it's really helped keep my hands in the last, 12 or so years in fighting shape. Because sometimes I would be in the studio and I would literally just get up and go to the restroom to run warm water over my hands. They hurt so bad. And you can't just take, you know, medication, you'll ruin your liver if you do it too much. So acupuncture is good, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's important that people be aware of that, because I think that, well, I mean, I know needle workers all over the place, their stitching postures and their practices are horrible. And
I mean, acupuncture for me was a complete game changer, because I was really starting to develop just non-use of my hands under some circumstances. And now I rarely am in that amount of pain. So for me, it was a total game changer. Really, really was.
Okay, we're going to run out of time, and we got to learn about your side hustle, collecting miniatures.
Oh my gosh! So I'm 5 years old. I collect 1/6 scale miniatures. That's like a 12-inch doll. So kind of think Barbie, but I do not collect Barbies or Barbie things. I've always loved miniatures. I've collected different scales over the years. 1/6 scale is nice because you can get a very high level of detail without busting the work on accident. I remember being a little kid, I had a 1-inch scale dollhouse that my mother and I worked on together. And I remember it would break stuff, because you're like a little kid, you're trying to do something, and the like little things would just, you'd be like, oh man. And so with a larger scale, it's easier to make stuff. So it's nice for that, that you can get that higher. And also, too, it's not as popular a scale. I went to a miniature show not that long ago, And oh, the 1/6 scale stuff, so expensive because of the, amount of refinement and technique to work at that size. And 1/6 scale is a lot more affordable, I will say.
Well,
But
I
yeah,
have
just, it's a.
to, on your Instagram page, you were showing your new oven range.
Oh, yeah.
Holy smokes, I couldn't
Oh, my
believe
snag.
the
Yeah.
detail. Wow.
Yeah, that was something that I purchased. There are a lot of 1/6 scale miniaturists, more so now. I started probably about maybe 11 or 12 years ago in that, seriously collecting. But it's way less expensive. It's not as a popular a scale. Like I could buy a piece of furniture for like $100, and then if it was a 1/6 scale, I'd be looking at two or three times that amount, if not more. So it's lucky as like collect something that's not as popular and it will be kinder to your wallet. But I have a lot. I have a lot, probably too many. When I in my old studio we used to play a game and it was, does Lauren have that in miniature? And most of the time I did. It's one of those silly things.
Now, is this for dollhouses or
Yeah, so I build dioramas.
okay, so you go that route then. Okay.
Yeah, and a lot of the stuff I buy pieces made by other artists, and I make kind of furnishings and simple things for them. But I'm not a woodworker by any stretch of the imagination. So, but yeah, I've got a lot. It's a lot. Yeah,
So
I don't know.
is that your escape from needlework then, is miniatures?
Sometimes, I don't know. I really enjoy looking at them. So they're actually in my studio. I probably a 15-foot wall of miniatures. And when I'm having a frustrating day, I just kind of like look over at it and go, ah, it just kind of resets my brain a little bit. But I love to collect miniature food, like miniature donuts and cakes and I again, like there's like this compulsion. It's like, do I need that? I need this three-tiered miniature cake that says happy birthday or what have you. I bought miniatures the other day even. It's like a vintage style 1970s oh gosh, pots and pans set, and it looked like enamel and something I had around when I was growing up. I was like, I need that. Etsy is dangerous. Etsy just makes it so much easier now to divest yourself of all of your cashola. Gosh, I love buying miniatures and I love buying thread, and thank goodness it's so small so I can have the volume of it that I do.
Yeah. Well, I the little video or clip or whatever you had of your collection, your wall of pieces. Holy
Yeah, that's a
smokes,
lot.
yeah.
That's just one. I have another
Oh, that wasn't
area.
all? Oh my.
No. Yeah, again, because I've collected it, it's one of those things when you've collected something for so long and you start young, by the time I'm not 40 yet, but I mean, it's like it's for years and years. It used to be small. It used to fit in like a little fishing tackle. And now it's like, oh, now it fits in a big box. I've never switched hobbies and I can't now. I'm too invested. Too
Yeah,
invested to ever switch hobbies.
you're way
Yeah.
down the road now. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm drowning. I'm drowning in it.
All right. So what is the next big thing at the San Francisco school that people need to get involved in?
Well, we are working on, as I mentioned before, that new class where, again, it's very independent study where you get to create your own project, and it's a week-long intensive with me, and I help you develop that work wherever you're stuck on it, or if you're mid-process on a particular piece, I can help you through that as well. So again, it's like one of those group independent study, which I find very helpful for students because, when you're in an environment, you're inspired by other people seeing what they're doing, and it can help influence your work for the better. And additionally, we are working on a professional training program and mentorship so we can empower people who would like to either start their own business, perhaps, teach embroidery in their own way, or even to promote cultural heritage. Needlework arts. Again, we want to empower people to be able to do that. So we're working on that. as well as new classes all the time. And I will be at Costume College teaching some costume related needlework techniques.
So is it San Francisco School, is that going to be an online class?
I'm the online focal, but we teach both in person as well as online. That week-long intensive with me will be held in person because we have really wonderful facilities and access to equipment as well as materials. We have our very extensive library and collection that are all tools to be used at the disposal of students to really help them produce their best work. And, you know, really, it's a great space to physically work as well. It's fantastic lighting. So I think sometimes, you know, when you're just getting started, you need the right atmosphere. Having what I like to call accountability buddies really helps you because, you know, a lot of people tell me, oh, you know, I do needlework, but I kind of hide it from other people because they don't think it's cool. Or even, you know, their immediate friend group or family groups aren't particularly interested. And, you know, without somebody to share your work with, you can sometimes lose, you know, the motivation to complete a piece or even learn something new. So that environment, you know, that we've cultivated at the school, it's very much about exploration and trying and encouragement and promoting people to do their best work in a positive way.
Lauren, thanks. You've been on quite a ride. This is fantastic. Wow.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for chatting with us, and thanks to everyone for listening.